Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Welcome again to If You Love This Planet. I'm Helen Caldicott. Today on the program, we're going to play a speech I gave in Berkeley, California in June 2009 about banning nuclear weapons. The speech was recorded by TUC Radio in Calpella, California. I hope you enjoy it. So much is happening in the world, but it seems appropriate that we're in Berkeley, where much of the nuclear age began. Lawrence was here at Berkeley. The Berkeley National Labs have been an integral part of the whole weapons complex, and the University of California and their regents have run Lawrence, Livermore and Los Alamos all the time since they set up those labs. It's a long time. And it's always really staggered me that regents of a university and educating young people to have a future are also working upon their annihilation. And I think that you must expand your outlook and realize that the Berkeley Nuclear Free Act does not just apply to the library. It applies to UC. It applies to the Berkeley labs. And that you have to make this whole place nuclear free or else you're hypocrites. No, I'm serious. I'm really serious. Linda, I want to honour you for what you've done. You're absolutely magnificent. I've been watching Michael Jackson, but I reckon you're better. And I'd like to get you on national television. And in fact, I've got a radio show called If You Love This Planet that plays on most Pacific stations. And the person who's organised the whole thing is Scott Powell. And he's responsible for If You Love This Planet, the book, which I've just revised at his instigation. Which I resented. War in Heaven.
The New Nuclear Danger.
The New Nuclear Danger, that I wrote just before Bush went in to kill a million Iraqi civilians or more. The New Nuclear Danger, George Bush's military-industrial complex. Anyway, this book describes the Vulcans and Condoleezza Rice's connection with the bomb makers and the military-industrial complex, which hasn't stopped. It's as powerful as it ever was. It's more powerful than the pharmaceutical companies, which you know about at the moment because none of you have free medical care. The Pentagon is the biggest socialized institution in your country. More money is spent on the Pentagon and weapons than on you, and you pay the tax dollars for it. So I reckon we get rid of the socialized killing machine and let's set up a socialized medical care system for all of you to have free medical care. We've got a free medical care system in Australia. We go to the doctor. My daughter's a doctor. She runs an integrated medical clinic. You pay your bill, you go next door, and the money's put straight back in your hand. My partner broke a leg some years ago, had surgery, was in hospital for 10 days. It cost $700. The whole thing. The anaesthetist, the surgeon, best surgeon in Sydney, and the hospital stay. I mean, that's what you deserve. And medicine is not a business. Medical care is not a product. Never use these horrible corporate terminologies. We are here to serve. Medicine is a vocation like being a nun. I won't mention priests at the moment because they're not looking too good. But nuns, I think, are still in the clear. As far as I know. I did medicine when I was first paid to practice medicine doing a locum. I was embarrassed to accept money. I mean, we always make enough to eat, and if the patients can't afford to pay you, they'll give you a chicken or a cake. But we're here to serve. And it's grotesque to see these corporations moving into my area, which is medicine. And we need to get the hell rid of them. I think Obama's still scared of them because they're so powerful, because they help elect every single blasted politician that you have. Well, the politicians are all corporate prostitutes, both to the medical industry, and I say industry, and they're corporate prostitutes to the military industrial industry. This is a killing society. It's very interesting, actually, that I'm just winging it now. It's interesting that if you murder someone in America, you get shoved in jail, particularly if you're an African-American, and you'll probably get the electric chair, right? Or an injection of poison. But the whole society is geared to killing, including that blasted Berkeley Labs, including UC. And the point is that, I don't know if you know, but, you know, we all thought when the Cold War ended and Gorbachev, bless him, he allowed the Berlin Wall to fall. And because he'd seen physicians, us, on television in Russia talking about the medical implications of nuclear war. And we all, thank God, we were so exhausted, we lay on the couch like couch potatoes and thought it would all go away. Well, then we got William Jefferson Clinton, a man with no courage, who had not been to Vietnam, not that Cheney or Rumsfeld or Bush or any of them had ever been to Vietnam, but he didn't have the guts to take on the Pentagon. They're scared of them. I think there's a bell-shaped curve of men. At one end, there's a group of men, and it'll be everyone in this audience, who would not hurt a fly or a frog or anything like that, and sensitive and in touch with their feelings and their right brain. Then the majority of men, I think, I've heard them all the afternoon revving up their cars, like they're just pumping their testosterone, especially when they're young, who would play video games all the time, who'd go to war but come back terribly damaged, and we see that now, these poor young fellows who are just really babies. I mean, they've only just grown whiskers, being taught how to kill. And then there's the other end, who a small minority of men whose reptilian midbrain has a toxic reaction to testosterone. And that's Rumsfeld, that's Cheney. Bush was too out of it, moronic, to even have a reaction like that. I think he rode his bike and went to his ranch. And it's Richard Pearl, I could go, Wolfowitz, I could go on and on. And these are the people who are so neurotic or sociopathic that their drives rise them to the top like cream. And you see it at universities. I saw it at Harvard Medical School. You know, they stab each other in the back, you know, because it is about power and control. And they psychologically kill each other on the way up. And you saw Rumsfeld doing that. You saw Cheney doing that. And we've seen it over time. I mean, LBJ was good at it. Most of them have been. And they're mostly males, except the women who join the power game have to behave like males in order to get to the top, usually, almost always. And so they prevail with their sociopathic tendencies. I think many of the people in the labs, there's a wonderful book by the anthropologist Hugh Gustafson. Gustafson interviewed the weapons laboratory people, and they are almost Asperger-ish. They have very hypertrophied left brains. They really don't connect with their feelings. Many have great difficulty, if they can at all, have relationships with other people, let alone women. And they are absolutely fascinated and tied to and married to their computer screen. And these are the people who have harnessed the power of the atom and keep going, because when they go to Washington, they're like Merlin with a cap on their head and their red carpets laid out, and then they come, and as the politicians are uniformly pretty scientifically ignorant, they give them what they want. And it's always been cloaked in an aura of patriotism, nationalism, and America's greatest, which I really resent on account of it's not. Like, what about Australia? We've got kangaroos and wombats and koalas and... I mean, it's a ridiculous notion. And advertising firms and the military-industrial complex all cater to this fact that America's the greatest. Thank God I don't think Obama believes that, because he's lived in various countries and he has humility. And he does understand other cultures, including the Muslim culture. So after 9-11, I was here on 9-11, I saw those planes fly in. I'd just flown into Eau Claire, Wisconsin to speak to, I don't know, 1,000 students that night at the university, and I thought, what am I going to say? So I got out the Bible, because it was a very big Bible belt, and I read what Jesus said: love thine enemies, do good to those who hate you. And then I got in a Greyhound bus to go across America, because no planes were flying, except the Bin Laden family was being flown out from America. You know, we don't know much about what happened at all. And swathed, the country was swathed in American flags. And at every little mum and pop store, there was God Bless America. And I thought, oh God, will they do the right thing and move out and say, you know, A, why did they kill 3,000 people? B, what have we done wrong? C, let's work, as Obama, I'm sure, would do, because killing achieves nothing. As Gandhi said, an eye for an eye makes the whole world blind. And we've got to stop killing. We have got to stop killing. And UC and the labs are totally devoted to killing. And the physicists. And they're paid by the killers who organise it, because that's where the money comes from. It's damn hard as a scientist to get jobs in industries which, I mean, the whole of America should be swathed in solar panels. There should be a solar panel on every single house and a solar hot water system. Solar panels on every parking lot, electric cars with, what are the lithium-ion batteries? Lithium's a bit of a problem, but anyway, you take your car into your parking lot, plug it in during the day, charge it up, drive it home, plug it into your house, and power your house at night. The technology's here. It would cost money, but if we stopped spending $1 trillion almost a year on weapons, and Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, Northrop Grumman, and Boeing, did you see their planes? Not too good. That Qantas cancelled many orders for the new plane because they've stuck the wings on with some sort of composite carbon thing. And they were too scared to fly the plane 48 miles back to Seattle. Why don't we redirect these wonderful, brilliant brains, and they are, into saving the planet instead of destroying the bloody thing. We had a big influence in the 80s. We did, all of us. We ended the Cold War together. But it's not enough. I don't know if you all know, we've still got 25 to 30,000 hydrogen bombs in the world, mostly hydrogen. Of those, Russia and America own 97% of them. So who are the rogue states in the world? Yeah. What is the evil empire? Russia and America, who hold us at nuclear ransom every second of every day. I don't actually know how we're still here. When I wrote The New Nuclear Danger, and as a physician collated all the data of the near misses, there are several, you know, false alarms every day in the early warning system in America, let alone Russia, where most of their satellites don't work anymore, and they've only got an over-horizon radar to see if America's sending weapons towards them, and the Russians know you've got a policy to fight and win a nuclear war. Do you know how you do that? Well, it's easy. Don't worry about people. That's just collateral damage. Let's think about the missiles. What you do is you launch a missile with a hydrogen bomb. You've got 60 H-bombs targeted on Moscow. They've got 60 targeted on New York. I wrote an article with Bob McNamara about that. 60! And all Cheney could talk about were terrorists. You know? Well, so, you know, if North Korea gets a bomb, it might blow up Seoul. But it can't blow up the planet and destroy life on Earth. Let's get our priorities straight. So how do you do it? You send a missile over, probably from a Trident submarine, and there are 14 of them roving around in the seas at any one time with, I don't know, 24 missiles. Each missile has 8 hydrogen bombs. I mean, it's absolute insanity, nuclear insanity. Those missiles, if they're in the Atlantic, take about 4 or 5 minutes to hit Moscow. And what you do is you, quote, decapitate Moscow. That means, what does decapitate mean? It's what they did in the French Revolution, right, with the guillotine. So what it really means is you kill Putin so he can't press his button. And then you send rapidly 2 missiles per silo, and the Russians have thousands, and they land very, very accurately because the physics is so good now, you can get it within feet of the target, blow up the missiles so they can't press their button. The fact that millions or billions of people will be killed is really neither here nor there, because it's about killing the missiles and the bombs, not killing the people. Read The New Nuclear Danger. It is psychopathic. But we are all part of it. So we're all practicing schizophrenia. There's a split between reality and perception of reality. Now, because the Russians think the same way, mostly their men, let's be frank, who are in this business, I've got a few solutions for that. Anyway, but they don't want to lose their missiles and for you to win their the nuclear war. So they've made a great big hole in the Ural Mountains with a missile that's called the Dead Hand. And if Putin is decapitated, up goes this missile by computer control and sends a message to every single missile in Russia to be launched before your missiles hit their missile silos. Oh, well, it makes absolute logic and sense, doesn't it? And then you go back to the caves when we were troglodytes. I suppose it was good for men to be strong and powerful, to kill the saber-toothed tigers or marauding tribes while we breastfed our babies in the caves, you know. But that impulse or instinct has not left the reptilian midbrain. And we are basically killers. But we're very refined now at the killing. Very refined. Have you all heard the description of a bomb dropping? I guess I have to walk you through this. I don't know if NPR still has this signal that goes, whoo, and a male voice says, we are just testing the emergency broadcasting system. Does that still play?
Yeah.
Well, this time it would say, and I want you to imagine, that the button was pressed in Moscow by accident 20 minutes ago. And we're not listening to NPR or KPFA, and the missile, they take only half an hour to get from launch to land. Half an hour. And in that space of time, half an hour, the satellite from the other country, yours, has picked up the attack and your weapons are launched and they cross mid-space and it's all over in an hour. That's how long it takes to annihilate the planet. And there are so many accidents, I can't believe it. The Air Force just sent 6 hydrogen bombs off in a plane. They didn't even know they were doing it. They thought they were disarmed, but they were hydrogen bombs. They lost them for 24 hours till they landed at some Air Force base somewhere in the country. These sort of accidents are occurring because why? Human beings are fallible. And we've developed a technology with which we have to be infallible. We are so arrogant. So I want you to imagine in 10 minutes this hydrogen bomb, and there are many targeted on Berkeley, you may be sure, like 10 or 20. How many do you reckon? I mean, they don't reveal their targeting strategy, and they really don't understand Russia's targeting strategy, but certainly since the Cold War ended, America's had the audacity to target China as well. Imagine! Since the Cold War ended. Well, you have to have an enemy, don't you? And if you haven't got one, you make one up. I can't imagine the evil going on in these blokes' brains. I don't understand it. So the bomb will come in and you won't hear it because it comes in at 20 times the speed of sound. Will explode here with the heat inside the centre of the sun, something we've never experienced. Dig a hole 3/4 of a mile wide and 800 feet deep. This is a big bomb, but as many bombs are targeted on Berkeley, I'm combining them for a 20 megaton bomb. That all that volume will be turned into the mushroom cloud, shot up in the air, very radioactive debris. Then 5 miles from here, in every direction, everybody will be lethally burnt, but most will be vaporized. A little boy in Hiroshima was reaching up to catch a red dragonfly on his hand against the blue of the sky, and there was a blinding flash. And all was left was his shadow on the pavement. And that shadow is in the Hiroshima Museum. Never before had we been able to turn human beings into shadows. A woman was running, holding her baby, and she and the baby had been turned into a charcoal statue. And that was a tiny, tiny little bomb. So most people out to 5 miles will be vaporized. Up to 20 miles, everyone who isn't vaporized will be lethally burnt and injured, lying in what is left of the streets, thinking, why didn't I stop this? The White House has been stockpiling for years, huge stockpiles of morphine just in case of nuclear war. We don't know where it is. Our syringes will be melted, the hospitals will be gone, and we'll be similarly dead or injured or vaporized. Winds of 500 miles an hour, much higher than any hurricane, five times greater, literally popcorn the windows and they burst into shards of flying glass that literally decapitate people. And the Pentagon's got a book called The Effects of Nuclear War about, with all the equations about how far a piece of glass travelling at 100 miles an hour will penetrate human flesh. They do a lot of this. They're more sophisticated than the Nazis. Then the whole area will be engulfed in a firestorm of 3,000 square miles, even in the middle of winter with snow on the ground because it's so hot. And what the Pentagon has never done is taken into account fire. All they calculate is blast and radiation effects. They never calculate fire. Fire is an incredible heat, so hot that if you get into a fallout shelter, it sucks out the oxygen and you asphyxiate like people did in Dresden during the firestorms. And then 3,000 square miles is huge and everything burns. And then the fires coalesce all over the country because every town and city with a population of, I think, 15,000 or more is probably targeted. The Russians targeted railway crossings, shoe factories, anything the enemy holds dear. As one American general said, I don't care if the enemy holds dear grandmothers. That's what we target. And I was so offended because I'm a grandmother. But that sort of thinking, I mean, these people should be treated in mental hospitals. No, I'm serious as a physician.
Absolutely.
As a physician.
Absolutely.
So because the cities are now full of plastics, wood, oil, you name it, there's a huge amount to burn. And this thick cloud of black radioactive smoke will rise up. And don't forget, the whole of Europe's targeted. Australia, New Zealand, Japan, China, America, Canada. There are so many bombs. And the smoke is very, very, very black, and it rises up into the stratosphere and covers the Earth with a cloud so thick for some years that the sun can't get through, and we get nuclear winter, and we and most animals will freeze to death in the dark. No one will be able to eat, the crops will all die, the whole thing. Even if India and Pakistan, with 0.03% of the world's arsenal, I think, had a nuclear war, would create nuclear autumn, and most crops in the northern hemisphere will die. Know that the air masses of the northern and southern hemispheres don't tend to mix at the equator, so what you get up here, you keep. Now, we talk about global warming all the time, which is extremely significant, and I've just written a book about it, and it's going to be just dreadful. And in James Hansen's view, the NASA meteorologist from the Goddard Space Center, we've got to stop burning coal now. Now. And you know, this oil, I was in the airport today coming down to you because I fly. Everything we do is dependent upon oil. We've reached peak oil. It's darn hard to find any new oil, except maybe in the Arctic, and it's great that the ice is melting because they can rush up there and get natural gas, coal and oil. Where are these people's heads? I mean, I keep thinking of it as a physician. I've got a patient in the intensive care unit really hovering between life and death with maybe septicemia and liver failure and possibly renal failure and the heart's starting to pack up. And so what I just inject another dose of bacteria in just to make it really effective. And the patient dies. I mean, the planet is in the intensive care unit. It is acutely clinically ill, or if not terminal, and we are all the physicians, not me, all of us. And that means not feeling psychologically comfortable ever again till we fix this, because we were, well, I'm not a Christian, but we were, it says in the Bible, we were given dominion over the planet, you know, and we are. We're the ones deciding, we're the microbes on the planet. You know how many there are of us? In the year 1800, there were 1 billion. Now there are nearly 7 billion in 200 years. That's called exponential growth. How on earth are we going to fix things? Well, maybe we should put contraceptives in the water supply of the water and aphrodisiacs to keep everyone busy, and in 100 years we'd disappear. Would that be such a bad thing? We'd live our lives. I want to live my life. But what we're doing is just quite extraordinary. I mean, I think really as a biologist we're probably an evolutionary aberrant. So your task here is so important. It's not just the library and those silly identification things, and the librarians are getting probably quite high doses of
electromagnetic radiation.
And that's been shown. I mean, cell phones, there are quite a lot of articles by neurosurgeons now, including one of my friends, that people are getting brain tumours on the side they use their cell phones. And the kids have them stuck to their heads, you know, and you see men walking through airports with this thing in their ear, you know. Feed my brain tumour. It's just crazy. Well, anyway, people are exposed to that with electric blankets or equipment in the kitchen, but particularly these librarians are at risk because they could develop malignancies. So, who cares about 3M? Who cares about, I mean, the books? Why don't we just go back to the old system of libraries? It's so crazy. I think there's a secret agenda. I think that 3M probably has a contract with the university because it's a weapons maker and it's into nuclear weapons. That's my hunch. I've got no evidence, but having watched this scene for many years, I'm almost certain that that's what's happening. And the council just tend to turn into pawns, you know. They do what they're supposed to do, and they will represent you only if you demand to be represented. Like Roosevelt said to a group of people once, well, you've convinced me, now you've got to make me do it. How do we do that? We start another massive grassroots movement. Most of us in this room are old. Have we got the... You're not. Have we got the energy to do it? You know, I'm 70. I'll be 71 in a minute. And I think... are we just going to keep going? Well, we have to, because I look at my grandchildren and I have to. And anyway, why live? We're not here to be hedonistic. We're here to serve. We're here to make other people happy. And we're here to save. I mean, I've just flown down from Portland. I can't believe what they're doing to the forests. So you can use paper towels, blow your nose on trees. That's what I blow my nose. It's called a handkerchief. And that handkerchief, if I don't lose it, will last me till I die. I wash it in the shower and it dries. Don't ever, ever, ever blow your nose on trees again. Do not use paper serviettes. Do not use paper towels. Think of the way you prodigiously use paper. And those trees are being chopped down. You know, even lavatory paper. You know, the really thick, bouncy gear. They get old growth forests for that fluffy lavatory paper because it's got a longer fibre and it can trap more air. Don't use it. Use recycled paper. It's a little bit harsher, but it doesn't hurt you. Bottom? It's okay. Does the right thing. In India, they don't even use lavatory paper. This hand is to wash themselves, which is very refreshing, actually. And this hand is to shake hands and to eat. But anyway, I mean, we can learn from other cultures. But what I'm saying to you is the trees, it's not just they're beautiful and they house the owls and the eagles and the hawks and the bear and everything. They are the lungs of the earth. And one of the main mechanisms to reverse global warming is to leave the trees intact. It takes a tree 500 years to trap the carbon. We chop it down, turn it into paper, it gets burnt, we release 500 years of trapped carbon. So, and they absorb the CO2 and they lay it down in the wood. It's okay to use wood for building, but not for paper. No, I'm desperate that the newspapers are folding, but maybe it might be a good idea in the long run. If we stop printing all the stuff from our internet, you know, we just use so much. You see, all the problems I'm enumerating, and I'm just doing a few, can all be solved. We've got now a president who has openly stated he wants to abolish nuclear weapons. There was an article in the Times today that Russia and America are getting together to develop a new contract, and Obama's going to Moscow next month.
Oh, right.
Well, what if he gets, I mean, George Bush, I mean, they had a contract that they'd get down to 2,200 nuclear weapons each. Well, that's enough to blow us all up several times over. It's called overkill. You die, and then you stand up again, then you die, and you stand up again. It's Pentagon language. So we know, but he needs not your help. You have to know that you're the leaders. And he's your representative. You got the force. But, you know, can I get on television? Are there any TV sets here? Cameras? No? I spent the afternoon, some of it, watching Farrah Fawcett. Now, hands up those of you who have seen that documentary of her dying of cancer. It's one of the most moving things I've ever seen because it's a vulnerable woman. She had carcinoma of the anus, which is just the worst place to get it. And it was very aggressive and metastasized to her liver, and she did everything to try and live, and of course, they don't. But to see someone just wasting away, and this is what I've done with my life. I've spent my life trying to stop people getting cancer. And these labs are spending their lives so that people will get cancer. Not just now, but for really all future generations. Plutonium, made in reactors, and it's stored at Lawrence Livermore, a lot of it. It's even on the playing fields. 1/1,000,000th of a gram, if you inhale it, will give you cancer. There's enough in 1 pound, they say, if adequately distributed, to give everyone on Earth cancer. You need 10 pounds for a bomb. Each reactor makes 500 pounds of it a year, and it lasts for 500,000 years. It gets into the fetus and damages the developing fetus like thalidomide, so babies are born with no brains, like what's happening in Iraq with uranium weapons, same as plutonium, does the same thing, or no arms, or single eyes, or the most grotesque abnormalities. They've gone up 7 times since America went in there and it's using radioactive weapons, which is a war crime beyond belief. So any country that gets a nuclear power plant, because don't you know that's the answer to global warming, because it's clean?
Yeah.
Yeah, but you see, the nuclear industry have millions, hundreds of millions of dollars to spend propagandizing us, and we all sit, probably not you people, like zombies with square eyes, square heads, square faces watching the television, and it comes at you so fast, it goes straight in the left brain and doesn't have time to be processed before it lodges in the midbrain or the, you know, the place where emotions are engendered, and we tend to remember that, you know. So, and in fact, Australia's exporting uranium now as hard as it can go. So we're exporting bombs, we're exporting cancer for all future generations and genetic diseases, of which there are now 25,000 described. And my specialty is a commonest fatal genetic disease of childhood, cystic fibrosis. We found the genes, but we still can't cure it. And I can't tell you how many of my patients have died, or helping a child die of leukemia. Or you've all known people with cancer. This is the ultimate form of preventive medicine. And we can't let the Congress, who are lobbied by the nuclear industry, vote for nuclear power. Obama doesn't quite understand it. I need half an hour with Obama. Like I had an hour and a quarter with Reagan, with whom I developed a doctor-patient relationship and held his hand for most of the time because he got very upset and his cheeks flushed, you know, when he gets anxious, and I had to pat his hand because he didn't know anything at all about numbers, technology, blue-green laces, nothing. So I had to, everything he said, I had to stop him and correct him.
What was the result?
Well, it's interesting because when I left, I thought, oh, my God, and, I assessed his IQ to be probably 100 average. But I also thought he had impending Alzheimer's, clinically, which in fact he did. And I thought I'd had no influence. And I went back to the Hilton Hotel and there was a sexy bar and people were drinking martinis. And I felt like going up and saying, do you know what I've just seen? It was like Chauncey Gardner in Being There. But you know, he started to say nuclear war must never be fought and can never be won. And he met with Gorbachev in Reykjavik.
Mm-hmm.
And I think 88. And the Russians came totally prepared with a whole plan for nuclear disarmament. The Americans came with no plan. So here's Reagan and Gorbachev meeting in the downstairs. I've been there, little tiny house, sitting room. Upstairs is Richard Pearl sitting on the lavatory with a board across the bath, writing numbers on bits of lavatory paper. We call it lavatory in Australia, not toilet, because toilet is when you wash your face.
Yeah.
So lavatory. So he's doing numbers, and then someone runs up and says, oh, my God, the Russians have proposed this, so he does more numbers. But they almost over a weekend, two mere mortals, got to agree to abolish nuclear weapons. I think that it partly came from that, I think. So it doesn't mean to say that it can't be done. It can be done. And we've got to think of new ways to get it done. But we're so lucky, I think, to have a highly intelligent, visionary, wise human being, prophetic in a way, to be the president. That's really, at the moment, one of the only things that gives me hope. But he needs your support. You need to get going. I mean, you need to form a massive movement in this country. So clearly the Russians are ready to get rid of their weapons. They can't afford them. They know the dangers. And I can't believe people walk around with a case of psychic numbing, thinking everything's hunky-dory and we might need to get this food from the Whole Foods shop, and as long as it's organic and it doesn't have pesticides, where, you know, tonight it could happen. I mentioned North Korea. North Korea, why shouldn't they have bombs when you've got 10,000? Why shouldn't Iran have bombs when Israel's got the third largest nuclear arsenal in the world? You can't, you have no moral standing to say we've got them all, we're the greatest on earth. You can't have any. What do people say? They say, well, who do they think they are? We're going to build some, and furthermore, if they have nuclear weapons, they're less likely to be attacked. Uh-huh. And America has one or two war games every year in South Korea with huge troops and arsenals, with the South Koreans practicing to invade North Korea. Uh-huh. All North Korea wants is a peace treaty, a non-aggression treaty that America signed saying she will never invade North Korea again. That's what they want. They want to negotiate directly with America, not with the six nations like Japan and Russia. I mean, they've got no right to be there. They want to negotiate with you, and I think Obama's getting around to that. But let's be frank, North Korea, as I said, could blow up a city. I'm talking about life on the planet, billions of years of evolution, 30 million other species. Do you understand that the responsibility is here, where it all started? And the Russians. Wouldn't hurt the Russians to unilaterally disarm. Someone's got to have the courage to do the right. What would Jesus do? He was a great prophet and a great psychiatrist. We have it in our hands to save the planet. We have it in our hands. I organised a book to be written by Dr. Arjun Makajani called Nuclear Free, Carbon Free. By 2050, the whole country can be operating without any carbon emissions and no nuclear. So, I mean, it's all ready to go, and the technology's here. He costed it out brilliantly. You can download it from a website, which I'll put up, called IEER. And I'm not taking questions yet. Be good. So we've got the answer to global warming. We can stop chopping the forest down. We can conserve energy so that 28% of the electricity used in America is wasted. You can conserve. Never use a clothes dryer again. Why have you got clothes dryers? Well, GE makes good things for life, like irons, stoves, clothes dryers, refrigerators, nuclear power plants, and nuclear weapons. So in order for you to use their electricity and they make more money, you've got to have a clothes dryer. What do we do in Australia? I've always dried my clothes in the sun, or even when it's raining, the sun shines the next day. I had three babies in three sets of napkins. We call them napkins, not diapers. We shouldn't be using trees for our baby's excreta. We shouldn't be using plastic. There's an island twice the size of Texas made of plastic in the North Pacific, in the vortex. What are we doing? Everything's plastic. I could go on, and it's all in the book that Scott and I have just done together, the revision of If You Love This Planet. So we can fix global warming, and I'm glad the Congress passed the Markey-Waxman bill. I've known Markey since the 70s. But it's not far enough, of course, and it's all been buggered up by... That's a word we use all the time. I'm Australian, I'm allowed to say that. It's all been buggered up by, you know, the lobbyists and stuff. Obama said there shouldn't be lobbies. He's right. They should be kicked out of Congress, totally.
Yeah, right.
And you should be there because you're the people that your representatives represent. Right? And in the absence, in the vacuum left, because Americans are pretty comfortable, in come the lobbyists with their money and their bribery and their corruption. So we're sort of on the way, and we can get rid of nuclear weapons, but Obama desperately needs your support. And I, you know, I'll help you. Maybe I'll come back to Berkeley, but we've got to fix the University of California and stop them supporting and managing the labs, number one. The labs need to be closed down, number two. There's no need for nuclear weapons. There never was. You know, how's this? We built nuclear weapons to stop nuclear war.
Duh.
And even a three-year-old child will say, but Grandma, what do you mean we built nuclear weapons to stop nuclear war? Grandma, that's stupid. Yeah, it's stupid. But it's power and it's control. And as Henry Kissinger said, power is the ultimate aphrodisiac. Okay, so what do we do with these blokes who like the power and control in all areas? Well, 50% of every corporation, university, board, Congress, State House should be women, because 30% is the magic number, below which women tend to act to please the men. And above that, the women have the control and they say, no, you're not getting yourselves today, we're voting for milk for children. And it crosses political lines, it has nothing to do with... Well, you know, I'm a conservative, and you are too. We are for conserving life on Earth. We're conservatives, not left-wing or any of that rhubarb. We're conservatives to conserve life on the planet. So we've got an absolute chance, but the opening is now, and if that closes in terms of nuclear power, in terms of exporting nuclear power and bombs, which America's big into, in terms of nuclear weapons, in terms of global warming, we can fix it. You're listening to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and that was a speech I gave on the subject of nuclear weapons in Berkeley, California, in June 2009. Now, on If You Love This Planet, I'm going to play an interview with Di Williams, which I conducted as part of a six-part series called The New Nuclear Danger for Pacifica Radio in 2005. Di is an independent consultant specialising in Korea, organisation and community psychological issues. At the time of this interview, Di worked with the EOS Life Work Resource Centre in the United Kingdom. So from the Pacifica Radio Archives, please enjoy this discussion between myself, Helen Caldicott, and Di Williams. It's my pleasure to welcome Di Williams to the show. Di Williams is an Englishman, so he'll have an accent a little like mine, so you'll have to tune in to the way he speaks. He started off as a psychologist and working in occupational health and safety. He became very aware of the toxicity of uranium weapons that were used in Iraq in 1991, in Bosnia during the 90s, in Afghanistan, and then again in Iraq in 2003. And he's done some interesting work in these areas. And Di, I'd like to ask you how you got started in this and what have you been finding along the way?
The first message was back just before the Balkans War in 99, and a Quaker friend forwarded me a message from Rosalie Bertel warning that it was likely that US forces would be using depleted uranium shells in the war in Kosovo. And I'd never heard of the stuff before, I'm not terribly interested in these sort of things, excepting that it rang an alarm bell against my work in Shell Canada on occupational health and safety when we were looking for what you might call low-dose, high-toxicity materials and the possible dangers from those in oil refineries. And we set up very careful health monitoring programs. So like 100% of the staff in the refineries would get a full medical every year. And we were looking out for what we would call bad actors in the chemical industry, things like benzene.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a psychologist, I'm not a medical person, but I was aware of the health and safety implications and the importance of epidemiology and toxicology as disciplines. So Rosalie Bertel's warning struck home.
Mm-hmm.
And I just started doing some internet searches and came across some of the, well, essentially mainly veteran websites and so on in the States. And what I saw, I didn't like. It immediately rang alarm bells. There was obviously some kind of the material was obviously potentially hazardous as a form of low-level radiation. And I think what I didn't like was the deception that I saw in the official statements about it, which went back a long way.
Yeah, you know, just to interrupt you, it's very interesting. There is a deception, and the Pentagon denies that uranium-238, which is they call depleted uranium, is dangerous. So let me just interrupt here for a minute and just read from my book, The New Nuclear Danger, George Bush's Military-Industrial Complex. It says, it's clear the Pentagon understood the medical hazards of uranium munitions well before Desert Storm. That's the first Gulf invasion. Numerous reports from the military acknowledge that uranium-238 can cause kidney damage, cancers of the lung and bone, non-malignant lung disease, skin disorders, neurocognitive disorders, and uranium does go to the brain, chromosomal damage, and birth defects. In July 1990, before the first Iraqi invasion, an army contractor warned, quotes, aerosol DU exposures to soldiers on the battlefield could be significant with potential radiological and toxicological effects. Under combat conditions, the most exposed individuals are probably the ground troops, except they're not talking about the civilians, of course, that re-enter a battlefield following the exchange of armor-piercing munitions either on foot or motorized transport. However, no warnings about the dangers of uranium were given to the American or coalition forces deployed during Desert Storm, let alone to the surrounding civilian population. Finally, in their only statement of responsibility, the Department of Defense admitted in January 1998, quotes, our investigations into potential health hazards of depleted uranium point to serious deficiencies in what our troops understand about the health effects DU posed on the battlefield. They tell them nothing. They say, oh, it's depleted, so you don't have to worry. Combat troops or those carrying out support functions generally did not know that DU-contaminated equipment, such as enemy vehicles struck by DU rounds, required special handling. The failure to properly disseminate information to troops at all levels may have resulted in thousands of unnecessary exposures. And to finalise this, the military cover-up was partially explained in a statement made by Lieutenant Colonel Ziem of Los Alamos Lab in 1991, quotes, there has been and continues to be a concern regarding the impact of DU on the environment. Therefore, if no one makes a case for the effectiveness of DU on the battlefield, DU rounds may become politically unacceptable and thus be deleted from the arsenal. I believe we should keep this sensitive issue in mind when after-action reports are written. So what do you think of that, Di?
Yeah, he had a lovely phrase in that statement. He said we had to garner our proponency or something, which I think basically meant we've got to keep it secret, otherwise we're going to lose a very valuable military material. And from a military point of view, he's absolutely right. And it's a magic material. It's incredibly versatile. It's very dense. It has the effect of being powerful incendiary material, which makes good sense for the military whose job it is to win battles. But this throws a huge moral responsibility onto the governments as to whether we win battles using radioactive materials or not. And as I'm not a legal expert, but I understand that that's totally in the face of the Geneva Conventions, first protocol to it, and just common sense. I mean, one doesn't need legal interpretations from my point of view. I'd look at this from a health and safety point of view, and I think when I read the information about it, it's a curious material because when it's in its metal form, like in shells before they're fired, sure, the radiation only is skin deep, and if someone's wearing gloves, it's really not a problem. it's dangerous when it burns, and then it spreads into the air and it becomes a toxic smoke, which is much like breathing in asbestos dust.
Mm.
And the military get amazing kind of amnesia when they think about what happens to it at the other end.
It actually reminds me, Di, of, you know, America's still set up to fight and win a nuclear war against Russia with 2,500 hydrogen bombs on hair trigger alert and vice versa. And
yep.
such an exchange of nuclear weapons would create nuclear winter and the end of life on Earth. Now, the military accept the data about nuclear winter, but they don't talk about it because they don't know what to do about it. So they still have their weapons set up to blow up the Earth and produce the end of life on Earth. I mean, it's the same sort of denial, isn't it?
It creates a practical problem for them. Again, my position is I'm trying to get to the facts with a non-political angle. I'm not mm-hmm. anti-military.
I am.
But I don't like what I see. And I'm trying to figure out how very highly skilled, intelligent military planners and scientists can kind of have a double think on this thing. And as a psychologist, I found very interesting was a guy called... a Yale psychologist, Irving Janis, in 1977, came up with a book called Groupthink, which it was his explanation of how there was such a total screw-up over the Bay of Pigs and how so many, it wasn't one strategic error, it was a whole catalogue of huge disasters by the administration and the Pentagon, totally misreading the situation because of wishful thinking. They read it as they wanted to read it, not as it was. And I think this groupthink has been kind of built around uranium weapons. They want to believe that they're safe because they're so useful.
Describe to us, Di, how they're so useful militarily. I'd like to hear that.
To penetrate through heavy armor, the problem is that a normal shell will tend to go blunt. This stuff, as well as being very high density, also it ignites when it starts hitting the target, and the point of the thing begins to burn, and it burns to about 5,000 degrees Celsius. So this thing becomes like an incredibly high-speed welding torch with a force of several tons behind it, and it just cuts straight through several inches of armor and then carries on burning to set fire to the ammunition and the fuel inside the tank.
And the soldiers.
Yeah.
So it's a fantastic weapon.
Yeah, this is the UK government's position is saying that this is the best thing which we've got available. In fact, more recent tests suggest it isn't that special because it very often misses. And the alternative tungsten is only just slightly less effective. But in any case, now they're not using those kind of weapons so much. They're using various types of short-range missile as well. The concern I've got was that in the Balkans war, that they might use these things, and if they did, that there should be use precautions for the target so civilians wouldn't get contaminated.
Mm-hmm.
I passed on the information I picked off the internet to BBC, and within two or three days they were very good. They covered it. They questioned NATO. They questioned government ministers. And when our guys went in on the ground after the combat, everybody was warned about it. They had bottled water and, like, tanks which had been shot up with the stuff were marked off. The problem didn't stop there. The problem was a couple of... What I did hear was that they were picking up radiation in Greece and later on also in Hungary.
In the northern part of Greece.
Within a few days of the bombing.
Yeah.
And when the United Nations Environment Programs actually got round to... When they were finally allowed by NATO to look into the uranium contamination in the Balkans, which didn't happen, they kept them out for 16 months. When they did get in, what they found was negligible. The stuff wouldn't, you know, they found a few of these things lying around. They found far too few, from what I talked to Doug Rockey about. These things are fired 200 rounds per target. The most they ever found was one spent shell. Anybody who's been in military knows that the stuff is all over the place. So somebody had been around and cleaned it up. And in fact, later NATO admitted they'd sent in 10 cleanup teams before they let the United Nations in.
I didn't know
so
that.
The problem was that these things did not account for the radiation 200 or 300 miles away. And so that was when I started looking at suspected use in bombs and missiles.
So how do you think the radiation got two to 300 miles away in the northern part of Greece from the Balkans?
Because it was being used in warheads which weigh up to 2 tons each, and where the smoke plume goes up to 5,000 feet and it blows for 200 miles. Not that it comes from an A-10 shell. The A-10 shells, I think, are a complete diversion.
The A-10 shells are the anti-tank shells?
Yeah, those are the ones which we were told about in the Gulf War.
What are the ones weighing 200 pounds?
When I started looking around, I discovered on the Federation of American Scientists website there's a whole slew of smart bombs and missiles which were upgraded in 1997, and some of them sooner, to destroy hard and deeply buried targets, in other words, Saddam Hussein's bunkers. And these were a whole generation of things. The most famous are the GBU-28 bunker busters.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not by any means the only one. The most common one is the 2,000-pound GBU-31, GBU-24, and those guided bombs. So these are the ones which they've used thousands and thousands of in Afghanistan and Iraq.
Well, are they all DU, made of DU?
No, but I estimate that about one in three of the guided bombs that they were using in Afghanistan and Iraq would have been hard target versions, which were for hitting underground targets. Certainly if they were attacking Tora Bora and the caves and the Saddam Hussein's palaces, that's what you were watching on television.
Mm.
These things go very deep, and they need high-density metal to go deep. And if they want to create firestorms when they get down there, and that's certainly what you see on the television in Iraq,
mm.
There's only two metals which work, tungsten and uranium. They're both very heavy, much the same. But the difference is tungsten is inert, whereas uranium burns
on
like
impact.
A firestorm. So my guess is, at least for the sake of estimating potential risks, is that if about one in three of the 6,000 weapons they used in Afghanistan and the 10,000 that they used in Iraq contained uranium warheads of the kinds which my reports have tracked down, then with an average weight of about 500 kilos of the secret metal, we're probably talking about 1,000 tons of contamination in Afghanistan and about 2,000 in Iraq.
So how are we going to verify this, Di, and find out exactly how much they did use? Will the Pentagon eventually tell us?
We've tracked down the American, the U.S. Patents Office has got patents for the 2,000-pound warhead and for the one of the Tomahawk upgraded warheads. So there's no doubt that this technology has been developed. In fact, it goes back to 1985. Mm. But the most likely thing is that if we get another round of Gulf War II syndrome, there are going to be some really angry military people who realize that they've been lied to by the scientists and the planners. And forget about international law. The most likely people to take this stuff out are going to be military people who say that we have just trashed most of our best special services by sending them into contaminated targets without protection because the scientists told us we didn't need to. And I think those people are going to be so angry in a few months' time. And also the veterans' families, because we're talking, if these weapons have been used in Afghanistan and Iraq, we're talking 100 times more contamination per target than anything you get off a 300-gram A-10 shell.
Mm.
We're talking massive contamination clouds.
Well, I'm waiting until we can get verification of this. I mean, the whole thing just makes my blood run cold. Thank you so much for this interview, Di, and I look forward to talking to you again in the near future.
You're listening to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and that was an interview with Di Williams, conducted as part of a six-part series called The New Nuclear Danger for Pacifica Radio in 2005.
For more information on this show or any of our other fascinating programs, visit our website at www.ifyoulovethisplanet.org. Thanks for listening, and please join us again next week.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.